Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Famine is imminent in the strip. They projected the phenomenon will arrive in the north of the strip between now and May. The report also said that half of Gaza's population, or 1.1 million people, are currently facing catastrophic hunger and food insecurity.
I'm Venetia Rainey, and this is Battle Lines. It's March 21st, 2024.
Regardless of who stands with Israel, Israel will fight until this battle is won.
两岸同胞要携手同心, 共享民族复兴的伟大荣光。
I've made wartime decisions. I know the choices are never clear or easy for the leadership.
I just find bombs and I find dead people, but it's a really scary thing for me.
On this episode of Battle Lines, we talked to our Middle Eastern correspondent Natalia Vasilieva about the second raid on Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital. We're also joined by our global health reporter, Lilia Sebwai, to discuss this week's stark famine warning and what can be done to prevent thousands more Palestinians from dying of hunger. Then we hear from our Asia correspondent, Nicola Smith, about one of her most intrepid reporting trips yet to the steppes of Mongolia. She tells us about her interview with the Mongolian Prime Minister and why he needs Britain's help to break China's grip on key rare earths and minerals. She also talks about a new national security law in Hong Kong and why it means troubles for newspaper lovers and priests alike. We start in Gaza, where the Israeli army has been conducting a second massive deadly raid of Al-Shifa Hospital. The medical facility in northern Gaza had barely started functioning again following a major assault in November that Israel said was aimed at rooting out Hamas militants. I spoke to Natalia to hear more. Natalia, maybe I can start with you. What is the latest on the ground in Gaza?
It may sound very unusual, but it looks like we have fighting back on in the north of Gaza. And we're now in the fifth month of war. And it's been a couple of months since Israel claimed that it has regained control. It gained control of the north of Gaza. And just a couple of days ago, fighting erupted around Al-Shifa Hospital, the biggest hospital in the north of Gaza, the area that should have been under Israeli control for a while. And just Wednesday morning, the IDF said that the operation around Al-Shifa is still continuing. Although it looks like they have gained control of the hospital compound as such, they say that around 90 Hamas fighters have been killed in that operation and that Israeli forces also detained about 160 suspects and they took them into custody in Israel.
What's the significance of this? Why are we seeing a second raid at the hospital if Israel already went in earlier in the war?
Yeah, I was actually talking to military experts and the former national security people in Israel about a possible resurgence of Hamas a month ago or maybe a month and a half ago when there were some reports of sort of sporadic clashes. It was also coming at the time when rocket launches from Gaza onto Israel largely stopped, but now and again there would be an odd launch from the north of Gaza where all of the Hamas presence should have been eradicated. And people were telling me at the time that this is the type of war that whatever Israel does, they will still have to deal with the north of Gaza. Whatever they do, they may claim that they decimated all of Hamas battalions in the north, but there would still be sporadic insurgent activity. And when I spoke to the same and also other people a couple of days ago about fighting in Shifa, dating back to our conversation a month earlier, the same people I spoke to earlier told me that it just shows that this is a war that will take a while for Israel to handle. And even if Israel decides to withdraw from Gaza or leave some of its forces, it would still have to deal with those insurgency, because you cannot eradicate Hamas. You can destroy the command structure, as Israel believes it did in the north of Gaza. So what I'm hearing is the fighting that has been going on in Shifa, on the Hamas part, it was not an organized resistance. So like there's no organized force or battalion fighting the Israeli troops, but rather what remains of the Hamas fighters. So there would be fighters who are disorganized, but like they're still left there. And it looks like this is a problem for Israel to deal with in the long term.
And I guess that has relevance as well for the Rafah offensive, right? Where there's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. The US clearly doesn't want Israel to go ahead. Israel is bombing the southernmost city of Gaza. There's some suggestion that maybe the offensive is already underway, but quietly. I think the Palestinian president suggested earlier this week. But if they do go in full force, as many in the international community are trying to make sure they do not, there's no guarantee that they will be able to root out the rest of these Hamas battalions for good, is that's what Al-Shifa essentially shows us.
Yes, exactly. Benjamin Netanyahu insists that the operation into Rafah should go ahead just exactly because of what we've been seeing in the north. And he claims that Israel simply cannot afford to have intact Hamas battalions in whatever pocket of Gaza there is. And they... To their intelligence, Israel says that it has intelligence that there are still organized forces of Hamas in Gaza, and that whatever happens next, that they do have to deal with it. And yes, they may have to deal with insurgency later, but at least it will not be an organized form of resistance. At least they will have dealt with tunnels, or they will have dealt with sites for rocket launchers. But again, like it just brings us to a broader question of the goals of this war and of the deliverables of what Israel can achieve. And the war, if I could remind our listeners, the war started with several goals proclaimed by Netanyahu, including the return of the hostages. It only happened partially thanks to one hostage exchange at the end of November last year. And the other goal was decimating Hamas. But again, it's an organization that has been in charge of the enclave since 2007. And there is there's a political level, there's a political wing, there's a military wing. And everyone you would talk to, people who know the region well, they will tell you that you cannot eradicate Hamas as such. You can damage its military capability. You can decapitate the leadership. You can try and catch some of the leaders. And it looks like at least one of Hamas's top three leaders have now been eliminated. I don't know if we spoke about it last week, but there were reports a while ago, probably last week, about Marwan Issa, Hamas's number three, possibly being assassinated in an Israeli airstrike. That report, Israel has not formally confirmed those reports, although the U.S. State Department actually earlier this week said that it's highly likely that Marwan Issa has been eliminated. It would be one big win for Israel, but in terms of destroy Hamas's capability, this is definitely far off right now.
And of course, in the background of all of this, although it probably shouldn't be in the background, is the fate of all the civilians in Gaza who aren't involved in fighting but are facing the risk of famine. And we had a really stark warning this week. Lily, I want to bring you in here. Can you tell us more about what we heard?
So on Monday, the IPC, which is the UN's Food and Hunger Monitoring System, released a report that warned famine is imminent in the Strip. They projected the phenomenon will arrive in the north of the Strip between now and May. The report also said that half of Gaza's population, or 1.1 million people, are currently facing catastrophic hunger and food insecurity. And this is nearly double the figure that was reported in the IPC's last report in December.
That's a huge number. We've obviously been hearing a lot of warnings about famine in Gaza for quite a few months now. Can you give us some context about how often these sort of classifications are made? How rare is this?
Famine's only been declared twice before. So Cindy McCain, who's the executive director of the World Food Programme, emphasised that this is a man-made and hunger and malnutrition crisis. And she called the speed at which it's going through Gaza terrifying. Just two declarations of famine have been made in the last decade. So in Somalia in 2011 and South Sudan in 2017. And these were both largely due to natural disasters rather than man-made. So Somalia was declared after three seasons with no rainfall. And South Sudan was due to a combination of war and drought.
What is the reporting in Israel like around this issue? Are newspapers and media outlets, do they convey these sorts of statements? Do you think people are aware of the scale of the crisis?
Oh, that's a very good question. Israel is a full-fledged democracy as far as what's happening around Israeli citizens and Israeli society. So you have a spectrum of opinion. You can go to a kiosk and pick up a strongly pro-Netanyahu newspaper, or you can pick up a newspaper that would be reporting on violence in the West Bank, about settler violence, about civilian casualties in Gaza. But mainstream media, television, and the most popular newspapers have largely been ignoring what's happening in Gaza by large and far. So you would say that if you're an average Israeli, if you're not a right-wing activist, or if you don't belong to what they call here the radical left, it's quite likely that you wouldn't know. Which brings me to a philosophical question about this war going on. Do you want to know? Or how much of an effort are you putting into getting into this information about something which is happening an hour and a half from Tel Aviv? You can be in Tel Aviv enjoying your cocktails or amazing springtime weather, and literally an hour and a half away, people are starving and struggling to find the most basic foodstuffs. It's about how this government has been depicting this war. And there was this really nice opinion piece in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, written by an Israeli writer who lives in New York. And he describes how he came to visit Israel for the second time after the Hamas attack, and how struck he was by how oblivious Israelis around him were about what's happening in Gaza. He wrote about sitting in cafes and chatting to people and enjoying a relaxed afternoon off while getting notification on his phone from other media outlets talking about the famine warning and other things happening in Gaza. So the dissonance is quite large. I would say it's quite astonishing what kind of information you're exposed to when you're in Israel and what you're not seeing, as if it just doesn't exist. And again, it's which really strikes me as a Russian. It doesn't happen because your government is willingly restricting the flow of information. Like, you're not getting punished for it. Journalists are not being jailed. Newspapers are not getting closed. It's about what the government encourages and what the public wants to consume, the kind of news that it wants to consume.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And Lilia mentioned that it's a man-made famine. Can you explain to our listeners what that means? There's been a lot of bandying about in terms of who is responsible for aid not getting in. Can you clarify that a bit for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first off, just as Lilia mentioned, the two times when famine was declared in the past decade was in Somalia and Sudan, both African countries where food insecurity had been high before that. They had faced different challenges in terms of food supplies and things like that. Gaza is quite different because before the war started, we did not see any reports of hunger. Obviously, there was quite an impoverished place, but it was not an area where hunger was any of the problems on the agenda. And now 5 months into the war, we have reports about the imminent hunger. Well, we have to start off with reminding our listeners that at the start of the war, Israel switched off the supply of water, electricity into Gaza. It closed all of the crossings into Gaza. Obviously, several crossings have been damaged in the attack because attackers from Hamas sort of rammed through those crossings and into Israel. Supplies into Gaza stopped completely at the start of the war. It took a while for them to resume. Obviously, because Gaza has been heavily bombarded, we cannot talk about agricultural products in Gaza as such. Before the war, Gaza was more or less self-sufficient in terms of certain kinds of fresh vegetables, right? If you were living in Gaza, you can just get local cucumbers and tomatoes. They would be growing in the fields and greenhouses in the north of Gaza. Now, all of these have been destroyed or erased by Israeli bulldozers. So we're not talking about any local supply here. And it took a while for international community to push Israel to open first one crossing into Gaza and then the second crossing. Deliveries are being hindered. And what we've been hearing from aid organizations is that they see it as deliberate. We have heard about, and the source for that is the head of the UN's Agency for Palestinian Refugees. We heard that convoys of aid would have been stopped and turned back because of one or two prohibited items in the case cited by the head of the UN's Agency for Palestinian Refugees. It was a pair of medical scissors. The whole convoy was turned back because that item was supposed to be prohibited. And that just one publicized case, it takes aid organizations complain that it takes too long to process the cargo, that some of the cargo is being turned back. And we're in a situation when we have hundreds of trucks sitting on the road outside Rafah in the south, on the Egyptian side of the border, on the Israeli side of the border, closer to the north, and they're just not being let in. So this is something that can be described as a logistical bottleneck. Israel continues to deny it's a problem. It says that it's happy to let anyone in. It accuses aid organizations instead of not following the rules or not working hard enough to deliver aid. But that's the situation. You have all of those trucks full load of food just sitting outside and not being able to go through.
Lilia, famine is a really technical classification, right? This is not a word that the UN bandies about lightly. Mm-hmm. Can you explain for our listeners a bit more about what that involves?
Mm-hmm. So for famine to be declared, it actually needs to meet all of these very specific criteria. So it occurs when an area has at least 20% of households facing an extreme lack of food, at least 30% of children suffering from acute malnutrition, and two people or four children for every 10,000 dying each day to outright starvation or the interaction of malnutrition and disease.
And so do we know which of those criteria Gaza is currently meeting or not meeting?
Mm-hmm. So the report said over the weekend, UNICEF said that 33% or one in three children under the age of 2 years of age are acutely malnourished in the north. A comparison prior to Israel's invasion, this figure stood at 0.8% for all children under five. The food crisis is affecting the entire strip, but it is particularly bad in the north, where some 300,000 people are remain trapped and cut off from the aid. The UN also recently confirmed that at least 10 children have died as a result of starvation in the north.
And Natalia, I know you've done some reporting on the death of these children, some horrible stories that we've seen coming out, and coping strategies that families are trying to implement, the sort of things that they're eating. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, the situation is particularly acute in the north. What we've seen so far, what actually we've been seeing for a very long time before those stark warnings were pronounced. We've heard reports of people resorting to animal food, any type of grain that would be used as animal fodder. People have been, we've seen pictures, videos, multiple evidence showing that in the absence of flour or any ordinary grain, people would resort to making patties or any type of cookies with animal fodder. There were also reports of people resorting to various greens growing in Gaza that would be edible, but that people wouldn't eat normally. For example, there is this type of green known as hubeza in Arabic. It looks like spinach. It grows on the side of the road. You know, as soon as I started looking into it, I noticed it around me in Israel, when you go to a park, you see it growing everywhere as a weed. So obviously there's a lot of it. And apparently in Gaza, because especially in the north, because parts of it have been heavily bombarded, people are even struggling to find those greens because a lot of green spaces would be close to the border with Israel, and that area has been particularly damaged and now is not safe because of the presence of Israeli forces. But yeah, we have seen people sharing recipes of what they make with this spinach-like greens, how they would steam it and cook and fry it. And it's obviously like people are resorting to whatever they can. And it definitely shows that, you know, it's a real problem if people are having to do that.
And so finally, what is the way to prevent famine from actually being declared? Maybe Lilia, I can start with you. What do the international community want to see happen?
Mm-hmm. So the report does also highlight that famine can be avoided if an immediate ceasefire is agreed. So it's just really important for that to happen. Basically, the World Food Programme estimated that to simply address the basic food needs, we need at least 300 trucks to enter Gaza every day and to distribute food, particularly in the north, where the World Food Programme has only managed to take 9 aid convoys since the start of the year. So we just need a humanitarian ceasefire and for aid to be able to re-enter the strip.
Just a humanitarian ceasefire. Natalia, what do you think needs to be done? What can be done?
Oh, yeah. I've been reporting about the hostage talks for such a long time. Every day there's a new report about how the talks are going. The bottom line is it's been 3 months, it's been almost 4 months since the last ceasefire, and we don't have any tangible prospects or ceasefire on the horizon. Of course, there's a solution, and aid groups are calling on Israel to open more crossings and to allow more aid to come in. The United States decided to build this floating pier off the Gaza coast. It remains to be seen what can come out of it. But what we've been hearing from the aid groups is that this is a band-aid on a gaping wound that logistically it's way too complicated than simply allowing more trucks to come in. And I think it's quite significant that in the recent days, particularly, we've had some strong words from some of the staunchest allies of Israel, including the United States and the UK, urging on Israel to specifically address that problem, to allow more trucks to come in and hopefully prevent that to happen or alleviate it if it's already happening in Gaza.
Thanks so much for joining us. That's Lila Sebway, a global health reporter at The Telegraph, and Natalia Vasilieva, a Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem. Now to Mongolia, a country rarely in the news, but one that is likely to become more and more important in the years to come. The landlocked country is one of the world's largest sources for rare earth materials, as well as significant copper and uranium deposits. Rare earths are key materials used in clean energy and defence products such as drones and electric vehicles. China dominates supplies of these crucial materials, but Mongolia's Prime Minister wants the UK to help end that. Thanks so much for joining us on Battle Lines, Nikki. You are currently in Mongolia. I'm speaking to you from Ulaanbaatar. So tell me what you've been up to there. I heard that you met with the Mongolian Prime Minister. What was that like?
So we arrived last week, and one of the first things we did was to interview the Mongolian Prime Minister. And I apologize in advance for mispronouncing his name to any Mongolian speakers, but Erden Livsanamsri. And he generously gave us an hour of his time to talk about geopolitics, Mongolia's view in the world, and also a very important subject, which is rare earths and critical minerals. So Mongolia is a vast country, about six times the size of the UK, but it has about 3.4 million people. So it's a country of vast open spaces and spectacular scenery. And it's sitting on top of extensive deposits of rare earths and uranium and copper. A lot of these have still yet to be mined, and we've still yet to discover exactly what is under the ground here, but it has great potential for all kinds of minerals that are needed for the clean energy transition that we need to fight climate change. And so it really puts Mongolia at the heart of a future geopolitical struggle over who controls these minerals, who has access to these rare earths. And we spoke a lot about that.
And those rare earths and things like copper and uranium, they're also really valuable for the defense industry, is that right?
That's correct, yes. And at the moment, China currently dominates the supply chain of rare earths, and it monopolizes 87% of global refining capacity. So Mongolia is sitting between Russia and China. It's been a democracy since the 1990s. And so it's a very attractive option for Western and other regional democracies to break that Chinese monopoly on these very valuable minerals, just in their own race against Beijing to secure these precious minerals for their own industries. And the Prime Minister himself described rare earths and critical minerals as the crude oil of the 21st century. He's very willing to deal with the West, to trade with the West. The issue for Mongolia is that it's landlocked and it's kind of sandwiched between China, which buys 90% of its exports, and Russia, where it gets much of its fuel from. And so that puts the Mongolian government in a very delicate position, even though they do want to have stronger ties with Western democracies and also regional democracies like South Korea and Japan. They've got to tread very carefully so as not to upset their neighbours and, you know, potentially put themselves at risk of some kind of economic coercion. And so one of the things we discussed was the ways to transport these minerals out of Mongolia. And the Prime Minister has already signed an open skies agreement with the United States to foster better trade. And he suggested that he would also like to speak to the British government about having an air route between Mongolia and the UK to help to get these materials out.
And you mentioned clean energy and defence. Can you give us some specific examples about what sort of things these rare earths and critical minerals can be used for?
They are needed for things like electronic vehicles, artificial intelligence, wind turbines, solar panels. So all the things that we do need to battle climate change. And there are some quite stark figures around that the demand for these kind of critical minerals and rare elements is expected to surge as much as 600% over the coming decade. And so everybody's looking for different solutions as to how they can get them to supply their own industries and to help nations meet their own policies in combating climate change.
And the UK has already been showing quite a bit of interest in collaborating with Ulaanbaatar on this, haven't they?
That's right. Nusrat Ghani, the industry minister, was here last year in October, and the UK is showing a lot of interest in cooperating with Ulaanbaatar on developing the critical minerals mining sector, bolstering supply chains. She was here speaking to government officials as well as Rio Tinto, which is the big Australian-British mining conglomerate, and they already are working on a huge mine here in the Gobi Desert, and they have a $16 billion investment in cooperation with the Mongolian government. So it's one of the issues that the UK is looking ahead. Like most other countries, they're looking to how they can bolster their own supply chains of these minerals, and Mongolia is one of the key countries that they're looking at.
And what was it like meeting the Mongolian Prime Minister? He was educated at Harvard, right? Can you give us a sense of what he was like?
Yes, so he's 43. He's a young Prime Minister. He's very progressive. He was very open to discussing very difficult geopolitical questions. He's seen domestically as a reformist. He was elected on a mandate to fight corruption. He was described to me today by a governor, the first female governor of one of the provinces in Mongolia, as a feminist. So he's really pushing for greater female representation in politics. And I got the impression that he was very open-minded, that he had a very difficult job trying to balance Mongolia's geographical position and historical ties with China and Russia, with the country's desire to cement stronger ties with Western and regional democracies. And so he and many other politicians in Mongolia came of age as the country was transitioning to democracy. So it's very important to the Prime Minister and to his colleagues to really allow Mongolia's democracy to flourish. And I think that's something that sometimes we forget in the West, that we're so used to democracy and we take so many things for granted. But if you live in a country where you've only had democracy for some 40 years, you've fought so hard for those rights and for those freedoms that it's still very much in your mind as to how to preserve them and how to really allow that kind of governance system to evolve and to become stronger. And that's really the impression I got from him.
That sounds fascinating. And for our listeners who want to read the full interview, that article is now up on the Telegraph's website. There's another story that I wanted to chat to you about, Nikki, and that's the passing of a new domestic national security law in Hong Kong. This is a subject that you and I have spent a lot of time covering a couple of years ago when we did a podcast called Hong Kong Silenced on the 2019 uprising in Hong Kong and the following crackdown by Beijing. What has happened this week? What's the latest development?
Well, this week, Hong Kong's parliament, its legislative council, it passed Article 23, it rushed it through basically after a brief 4-week consultation. This is a law that aims to criminalize dissent even further than what we saw in 2020 when China imposed national security law on Hong Kong. And that was essentially to crush the protests that had really shaking the city from mid-2019 to the start of 2020. It is decades in the making. It meets a constitutional obligation for Hong Kong to enact its own security legislation. But the last time Hong Kong's legislature tried to push this through in 2003, it was shelved due to mass protests in the city. First of all, the passing of this law after such a short period of time. It's really rushed through the public consultation that lasted just 1 month. So first of all, it's very symbolic that it's managed to just impose this on Hong Kong's people. It's very symbolic of the crushing of protests, of the right to gather, the right of freedom of speech, that they've managed to do this. And it basically, it brings even more oppression to a city that has already seen its rights shrink beyond anything that anyone could have imagined. Just a couple of years ago, Chris Patten, who was the last governor of Hong Kong, described it as a final nail in the coffin to civil liberties. David Cameron, the foreign secretary, has also said that the law was rushed through, that it will have far-reaching implications for freedom, that it has very sweeping provisions that are very hard to define on national security and external influence. And the foreign secretary has said that it fails to provide any certainty for international organizations, including diplomatic missions. Businesses are also worried. So it has the national security law already imposed very harsh punishments of up to life imprisonment for ill-defined forms of dissent and criticism of the communist regime in Beijing. And it basically adds to that. It criminalizes dissent even further.
Can you give us any specific examples of things that people could now be prosecuted for?
Yes. So this law updates or introduces new penalties to prohibit treason, sabotage, sedition, theft of state secrets, espionage with sentences of up to life imprisonment. And an extreme example is that a Hong Kong citizen could be imprisoned for keeping an old copy of Apple Daily, which is a newspaper that was run by tycoon Jimmy Lai, who is now currently in jail on charges of breaching the national security law that was introduced in 2020. And Apple Daily was shut down by the authorities. So now we're in a situation where if you have old copies of this newspaper, you could be subject to these new national security provisions. It also gives the Hong Kong police more powers to extend detention without charges and prohibit suspects from consulting with certain legal representatives, which human rights activists have said could undermine due process. You're looking also at stiff sentences of up to 20 years for espionage, up to 10 years for unlawful disclosure of state secrets, but nobody knows where the red lines are. These are very vague provisions, and nobody really knows what could trigger action under this national security law. And so businesses, especially professionals who deal with sensitive corporate information, are very worried about what this state secrets definition could be and whether they could be affected by it. And the media are also very worried. And the Hong Kong authorities have not really offered much assurance that that you could not be prosecuted for what would seem to us a very minor issue.
And there was quite a sort of visceral demonstration of that this week when I think the Catholic Church tried to reassure priests that their confessions would be considered an exemption, but it's not clear at all from statements that we've had from Hong Kong officials that would be treated as such. Is that right?
That's correct. So the new law requires Chinese citizens to report to the authorities if they know that others are committing treason. And so failure to report could be penalized by up to 14 years in prison. And it appears that religious professionals are not exempt from this, so even during confessions. And that's obviously extremely worrying. And it's a very extreme step for a city that has seen its rights, its freedoms eroded in a very rapid and very brutal way over the past few years.
Just finally, because I know you used to do a lot of reporting from there, do you know many people still living there? What kind of things do they say to you about what life is like, or have they all left?
Well, if I look through my contacts book now, most of the activists or even legislators or lawyers that I used to speak to are either in jail under some spurious accusation of breaching the national security law, or they're in exile, whether it be in the UK or whether it be in Australia or Canada. And even there, they are still being pursued relentlessly by the Hong Kong authorities. The national security law that was introduced in 2020 is extrajudicial and extraterritorial, and people can be prosecuted abroad. I mean, we haven't seen that happening because people are living in democracies who are not going to extradite them or charges under the national security law. But when I speak to Hong Kongers in the UK, they are very concerned that we don't forget about what's happening in Hong Kong, and that we do keep it in the headlines, and we do, and that the government does try in whatever way is possible to keep up pressure on the Hong Kong authorities, on the Chinese authorities, not to erode people's rights any further.
Thanks so much for joining us. That's Nicholas Smith, our Asia correspondent.
Hi, listeners. David Knowles here. It's been nearly 6 months since the start of the Israel-Gaza war, and for the grim anniversary, we want to look back over the past half a year and answer your questions on the conflict. So, in a special episode of Battle Lines, I'll be joined by our Middle East correspondent Natalia Vasilieva and senior foreign correspondent Sophia Yan. If you would like your questions answered, please send us an email. Of course, we prefer direct questions, not comments, but do let us know where in the world you are listening from. We'll do our best to answer as many as possible. The email address is battlelines, that's all lowercase, battlelines at... The email address is all lowercase, battlelines at telegraph.co.uk. That's battlelines, battlelines, at telegraph.co.uk. And of course, you can find the address in the show notes on the podcast apps as well. Thank you very much for listening.
That's all for Battle Lines this time. Please join us again next week for more of The Telegraph's best foreign reporting. Goodbye. Battle Lines is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our news, analysis, and dispatches from around the world, subscribe to The Telegraph or sign up to Dispatches, which brings stories from our award-winning correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a live blog on our website where you can follow updates on Israel and Gaza as they come in throughout the day, including insight from contributors to this podcast. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Battle Lines on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it really helps others find the show. As disinformation is a particular problem during conflict, we are relying on your support more than ever. Battle Lines is part of wider Telegraph foreign coverage in our podcasts. If you're interested in finding out more about the war in Ukraine, you can listen to our sister podcast, Ukraine the Latest. Battle Lines is produced by David Degahi, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com